Tampa. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Today's morning show, we are replaying a memorable morning show conversation from several years ago with Henry Greenspan, a psychologist and playwright at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, who happens to be the brother of someone I know very well in Racine, Ellen Cardwell. Professor Greenspan has spent decades speaking with various Holocaust survivors and has shared their stories in several different books, a wonderful play called Remnants, and especially in a book called On Listening to Holocaust Survivors, Beyond Testimony, published by Paragon House. One of the things you mention in the preface to your book on listening to Holocaust survivors is that you were very lucky to begin this work when you did back in the 1970s. Can you tell us about that? Why that what was interesting and beneficial in a sense about the timing of when you began all of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the things that was central was the fact that in those days, there were very few, in fact, there were none of the large testimony projects that we have now that some of your listeners will know of, the Shoah Foundation that grew up in Los Angeles partly in response to Spielberg's Schindler's List and the programs at the museum in Washington and so on. None of that existed at that time. There were some very early projects right after the war, meaning right in 1945, 1946. Most of that work was unknown. So when I began with survivors, there was no model what an interview with a survivor was supposed to look like. Of course, this was also in the days before, at least as far as I knew, video cameras and so forth. There were audio tapes. There was oral history that had begun a few decades prior. And I suppose that was my model, and being a psychologist was also a model. None of these interviews were therapy. But I assume, just because of my background, that if you're going to sit down and talk with someone about important, to say the obvious, moments and experiences in their lives, it was likely that more than one session would be necessary, would be ideal. I just kind of assumed that. But I didn't, you know, it depended on each person. But being that there was no model, the survivors and I could, in essence, make it up as we went along. And that's really what happened, because they didn't know what it was supposed to look like either. So people would say, I mean, I often quote this, but people would say literally, it's a long time ago now, of course, they would say, Hank, so you'll come back next week, we'll talk some more. You know, I had no exact expectation of when or where or how, but I said, sure, you know, I was honored. And so we did, and as you mentioned early, with some people, those conversations went on for months, in some cases years, and with a few people, we're still talking now, almost 40 years later.
Wow.
I don't want to suggest, you know, every week or every month, but, you know, in many cases, these are people who've become close friends, and it's not that we only talk about what happened during the war now. We know each other as whole people, and I do believe that that, among other things, created a just different way of knowing and collaborating in this sort of work than the what we've come to understand as a testimony interview. Usually, video camera, the place is fixed either in a studio or in someone's home, and they get 2 hours, and that's the end of it. I mean, there's a lot that can be learned and a lot that can be done in that format. And some survivors I've come to see also prefer that, the limits of that, but others feel constrained by it. And there's no question that one learns, hears, and understands things in an entirely different way when you have the chance to know somebody really well, the ways that they might first reflect on what happened and the significance, does change in the ways they talk about it. I'm not talking about specific episodes and incidents, but the meanings that people apply. And, you know, in, as I say, in some cases, I grew up myself as they grew up. And so, of course, looking back at the war as their own kids grow up, as their grandkids emerge, as they retire, as they deal with illnesses later in their lives, you know, all of this refracts the ways that they understand and talk about what happened during the war. And obviously getting to know me as not just this guy, you know, with a tape recorder, but as someone who is, in fact, a friend and who knows who they are. I mean, I can give specific examples of things that changed, but I'll be quiet for a moment.
Well, I'll be anxious to explore that. Let me ask you, though, first, if there was not really much precedent for what you were doing,
right,
and because this groundswell of efforts with things like the Shoah Project had yet to begin, how was it that you started doing this then? Did anything in particular serve as a catalyst or inspiration?
Yeah, I think I'll mention two things. One was a trip to Israel I took back in, I was in college in the 60s. About 68, and I met relatives there who were, I had met their parents who were in New York, who were survivors, but this was not part of my own family history that I knew of. I mean, I didn't grow up with this. I'm not a child of survivors. But when I met my cousins or second cousins in Tel Aviv, and they talked about their own parents and some of what they experienced as kids, because these are people who are still alive during the end of the war. Anyway, they were kids. They didn't remember much personally. But I came to feel, well, this is part of my history. I was always kind of in love with history. I'm a psychologist, but I'm a psychologist who is somewhere between psychology and history. So I had a different sense of the relevance of this history in my own life. But it sort of just sat there. And then in the 70s, I was working on another project, working with a psychologist who I was an interviewer, which I love doing, as you do. And I was interviewing, in a research context, people on the topic of, quote, moral development. And what we did as interviewers is we posed kind of canned dilemmas, set up stories, and then would ask people, so what do you think the person should do? What would be the right thing? Why do you think so? So it's very interesting work, I will say, how people thought about that. Just by coincidence, one of the people whom I happened to interview about 3 months in was a Holocaust survivor. I didn't know that right away. This was just accident. But he said to me, about three dilemmas in, he said, so would you like to hear some real moral dilemmas? And I said, sure. You know? And he started to talk about some of what he went through and experienced, whether to stay in the ghetto with his family or, as a young person then, you know, there was a possibility of his leaving and joining the resistance, the partisans in the forests, but that would mean abandoning his family. What's the right thing to do under those circumstances? Being later in Auschwitz and being in barracks where some people were stealing bread of other people, what do you do? These are other prisoners. What do you do in that circumstance? What is the right thing with fellow victims to control that? And it went on and on and on. What should have been a 2-hour event became a 12-hour event, which is sort of sort of set the stage in a way for what I ended up doing later, just sort of talking with people forever. And I was, I guess, blown away would be the way. There was just so much he had to say and so much I was learning, not only history, but all his reflections, you know, how he got through issues of faith. These are things my students always want to know. Yes, they're interested in the history, but they want to know what it is for a human being to experience this and how do you go on and how do you think about divinity? How do you think about humanity? And all of that was part of this discussion. And he also told me that I was the first, quote, first American with whom he'd spoken. That blew me away.
Wow. Well,
here we are 30 years after the war, and I'm the first American? It's impossible to me. But in fact, I was to hear that a lot. Now, you know, sometimes things are more complicated. There were you know, this or that individual along the way. But in general, it's the case that it wasn't until the later 1970s that the interest in this history and in engaging survivors specifically really changed. And during the first, most of the first three decades after the war, there was relatively little again. So I felt it wasn't a sense of responsibility. It was a sense of, in a way, privilege that I had this conversation, this long conversation. And that, I think, was the real change for me. Then I decided I really want to stay with this. This is something, you know, it's kind of like finding a calling, I guess. And so I did, and the reasons I stayed were partly that, but also, you know, it sounds almost strange to say, perhaps, but I have had the chance to meet and get to know extraordinary people, very different kinds of people, diverse people. Not everybody is a saint. Not everybody is, you know, is wise and wonderful. But to be honest, many are. I guess it's been a, I mean, these are people who've become, in many cases, like extended family for me. And in a way, for whom I became extended family because we got to know each other so well. And not in every case. Sometimes it was more like a professional relationship, but still sustained over years, and sometimes more intimate than that. But either way, for me, it was always about learning with people. You know, there would be things I would say, and you know this as an interviewer, you know, I might ask a question or reflect back something, and they would say, you know, I never thought about it before that way, or I haven't thought about it in years. So they would learn, in some cases, as much from our interviews as I would learn. And that is, you know, as a teacher and as a therapist, I mean, what's better than that?
really, nothing.
Right? Yeah, nothing. And so, yeah, that for me is what a really good interview entails, where both people are learning together. I mean, that's what I say when I write about this stuff.
Yeah.
And so often, as you well know, and what you do, interviews don't go there. But I had the luxury because I could go on and come back the next time and think about what we already discussed and go a little deeper and ask all the questions I wished I'd asked the week before.
Right. You say in the preface to your book on listening to Holocaust survivors that this lack of precedent, which we've already touched on, allowed you to develop your own method, you say, as much by experiment as by design. Tell us a little more about the tangible nuts and bolts by which these interviews came to happen, and maybe what the first ones were like versus what the other ones were like as you sort of did this a little bit longer and refined the process in a sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will say one thing that was always true is that this is partly, I think, my psychologist's background, is that I never assumed that the same format would necessarily be appropriate for different individual people. That's a big difference between what I've done and, we'll say, most of the large projects. Now, it makes sense if you're creating an archive and, you know, you want all the interviews to look vaguely the same, a similar kind of background, and as they say in movie land, you know, production values and so on. But from my perspective, I tried as much as possible to let the survivors lead the way. So that meant, how long we met, where we met. There were people who wanted to meet in their homes with other folks around. There were people who did not want to meet in their homes, but in a more neutral setting or in a room in the Jewish Community Center. And there was always a reason for that. Which would emerge over the course. But I gave as much leeway as I possibly could to every dimension because I assumed that this was all part of their retelling. This was all part of their process. So rather than put people in a box and assume, you know, this is the way to do it, let's just see. Let's let it evolve. So it went very differently with different people in that regard, which, as I say, that was in a way part of my method, which is to not have one in that kind of cookie-cutter version. And I would say a very quick example from a colleague of mine who's been working more recently with other survivors and who has met a number of people initially who did not want to sit down with him, or even over the phone and have an interview, because it was too difficult for them. But some of these folks, this was not something he invited, but they, you know, you can do these days, they started to send him emails, you know, a medium in which they had more control, more anonymous in a way. They could say whatever in a short bit, and then he could respond. And he has these ongoing email relationships with a few survivors that have also gone on for, in the case, for a year or more. And their, quote, story has emerged in that way. You'll never see that in an archive. You know, you can't put serial emails. I suppose you could. But this is not like a bunch of videos. But this is, the medium and the form really makes a difference in terms of what will work best for different people for different purposes. In my own case, I think the key that changed is that, you know, I did my own transcribing, and anyone who does their own transcribing knows, first of all, it takes 10 hours to transcribe at least one hour of an actual interview. Course of transcribing, I mean, I didn't have the money to pay anybody, but I wouldn't have wanted to, because I, first of all, heard all the things that I missed. You know, you listen to a recording, you say, oh, my goodness, I completely missed the boat there. I need to come back to that. Or reframing a question or revisiting a particular thing that I didn't think the first time I understood as well as I could. So that having multiple meetings gave me the chance to do that. One very specific thing I would do with most people is that if there was a specific section, it's very easy to do with audio tape, in which a survivor talked about an episode or reflected about it, I would bring to the next interview that section of our conversation on audio tape, and we would listen to it together. And I would perhaps express, or they would, oftentimes they did before I did. I'd say, you know, I wasn't sure what you meant by that. And people in general, and you know this, while a lot of us are shy initially and say, oh, I don't like the way I sound, you know, on tape and all that, most people really found it fascinating to hear themselves reflecting and remembering, and had a lot to say about, a lot more to say perhaps than they initially did about whatever that was. And I think also that cemented what I call a collaborative relationship, or knowing with survivors, not just knowing from them, because we're working over the same interview together. And it's focused on them. I sometimes say an interview is two people working very hard to understand the experience and reflections of one of them, right? In this case, the survivor. But we're still working together to do that. So that kind of collaboration was, I mean, I came to realize this really is where the ball game is, this kind of working together. And, you know, without saying there's only one method, because there are many good things to be doing, I think this is also quite different than the one-time video testimonies that we mostly see. It depends on the person, on both sides, and the chemistry they have and so on. But most such interviews are not collaborative in the sense that I'm describing, in part because, again, there's not that opportunity to listen over. There's no transcribing anymore, as you know, mostly. Everything is kind of digital. And so it is whatever it is. Mm. But that collaborative engagement is less likely to happen.
Right. We're speaking with Hank Greenspan about a book of his called On Listening to Holocaust Survivors, Recounting and Life History. Another book he's written is called Reflections, Auschwitz, Memory and a Life Recreated. The work which he has done in conducting interviews and re-interviews over the course of decades also led to the creation of a radio play and ultimately a stage play called Remnants. In the preface to the book On Listening to Holocaust Survivors, you talk for a moment in a really intriguing fashion, and this is interesting even apart from the central matter we're talking about today, the contrast between spoken and written retelling. Yeah. And you say that a lot of people kind of jump to conclusions about mm-hmm. what it is about writing that sets it aside from when somebody right. simply speaks about something. And you say that the distinction is really not the most important one, has nothing to do with spontaneity and has something to do with something else.
Yeah. If I may, because this bears on the on this issue, the subtitle of the new version of my book is I'm listening to Holocaust survivors, Beyond a Testimony, and that bears, the recounting of life history was the initial version, and obviously I greatly appreciate you mentioning it at all, but if anyone's interested, you know, it's quite a different book now than that, because it's based on later years and more stuff, and a reflection on exactly what we're talking about is much more central in it, which is the whole process of doing this kind of work in this different kind of way. So Beyond Testimony is specifically my way of saying testimony is great, but it's not the only way, you know, meaning the usual model of gathering testimony is not the only way of engaging survivors. It may not be the best for some purposes. So that's why I kind of underline the new subtitle. But in terms of this question of written and spoken, yes, there was. It's interesting to me, especially among literary professors who, in general, are people who focus on texts. This is like historians usually focus on documents. Unlike, I will say, professions like my initial one as a clinical psychologist, you know, working directly with people was familiar. I mean, that's what I did. Whereas literary people, historians, tend not to do that. And ironically, perhaps, when they started to engage people or even listen to the recordings of other people, there was this kind of enthusiasm and excitement, which I thought was great. Like, my goodness, you know, this is wonderful what people are saying, you know, like right out of their mouth, rather than, you know, in memoir and books and so on. But in my view, they kind of went to the other extreme in the sense that some number assumed that because someone is saying it rather than writing it, that inherently makes it more spontaneous in the moment. It's as though they're creating their story, quote, right before your eyes. And the reality is sometimes that happens, especially, as I mentioned earlier, for people who had not spoken before, especially with someone who's not a survivor. When I should have qualified and said, you know, the man who told me he hadn't spoken with an American had spoken many times with other survivors. So one of the results is that a number of survivors, just as we all do, had established ways, kind of repertoires of ways that they knew kind of worked in the way they put their experiences together. We all have this, yes? If we talk about our trip to Wisconsin, or we talk about our an illness we went through or a loss or whatever, and over the years, you know, we realize there are certain stories that make certain points that we tend to retell in different contexts. Maybe with some people we know very well, you know, we have the longer version, and with people who just ask, how are you doing? You know, we have the shorter version. Survivors are no different in that regard. You know, so they have versions which are not just born in the moment often enough, but through the process of collaborating and through the process of question and answer and through the process of sustained acquaintance, things also change. So it's a combination of what is spontaneous and created in the moment or retold in a different way in the moment, and what is relatively fixed and more like writing. The bottom line in my view about all this is that I go out of my way, and I will say with a little edge, to say that people are not texts. You know, my good colleagues in history and in literature, and this goes with, I think, modern literary theory, everything in the world is a text. And, you know, as a psychologist, I say, no, it isn't. You know, some folks are folks. They're not texts. And the difference between a text and a person is that a person can tell you whether you missed the boat or not, right? I mean, you can read a text or listen to an interview very carefully, and you can learn a lot. And my goodness, I've learned a lot from the memoirs I've read. And those are texts. And I didn't have the person in front of me to ask, so what did you mean by that? And to go back and say, you know, all I could do is just read as carefully as I could. So that's fine. But there is a big difference when you can ask the not text but human being, work with them to sort through what something might mean. Doesn't mean that they necessarily know. Doesn't mean that what they say is necessarily the, quote, right answer. But what it means is you have the chance to work together. You contribute what you think, you know, you can bring to the table. They contribute what they know from experience as well as their own reflection over the years. And out of that comes what's really a product that is created together. Yes, that's one of the ways I differentiate this kind of approach from the view that, ironically, in a way, these testimonies are texts, and yet there's also the sort of celebration of their spontaneity. How that goes together, I can't tell you. You have to ask the literary professors about that, because you see both. It's on the one hand, I don't get that entirely, to be honest. I mean, I get it, but I don't agree with it. And so, you know, I'm a bit of an academic troublemaker in these respects, too.
Right.
I'm not shy about saying, no, they're not texts, they're human beings. Listen to them, work with them, you know. And I wouldn't be self-righteous about it, but sometimes it's a little tedious to
sure.
do the whole text thing.
One of the distinctions that you make that I think is also worth talking about is when you say survivors' deepest reflections are less about what they remember
right.
than about what they know in their bones. And this is probably important for us to try to grasp and reflect upon, because you're saying that at a point in time when I think a lot of people find themselves gravitating to the facts, the black and white of what really happened. Tell me exactly what happened, and aiming for accuracy and for
yeah.
telling a story in that respect. And when you start talking about these kind of distinctions, it throws a bit of that into question. So help us understand what you mean by that this is about what they know rather than about
right.
what they remember.
But on this good question and difficult question, I will say this is an example of where I'm going to learn something I didn't know in answering your question to really be able to articulate this well. We assume that what survivors have to retell are memories, and of course that is true in significant part. So what's the difference between memory and what I, as you quoted, call knowing or even knowing in their bones? I think of memory as one kind of knowledge, and it's knowledge, the knowledge that survivors have, of course, is grounded in memory, meaning it's grounded in things that they experienced and which they can recall. But what stays with them on, I don't even want to say a deeper level, but sometimes the most significant level is not this or that particular memory, even horrific as it may be, and I am in no way minimizing that, but the wider implications, which is more like knowledge, which is that it can be true, and obviously was true, that one's life, not only individually, but as an entire people, this is what we mean by genocide, can mean nothing. We can indeed, we as whatever people, can become entirely beside the point. And I, when I say beside the point, I mean that almost like geometrically or topographically, that if the point is life goes on and the world keeps turning and so on, then in context of genocide, whether you live or whether you die becomes essentially irrelevant because you're dead. As far as the world is concerned, or the relevant world, you don't exist anymore. And, you know, in the Holocaust, as is true at other genocides, it was not only that people were killed in mass numbers, which is true, obviously, and that people's cultures were erased. That's the right word, erased. European Jewish culture, as it existed in very diverse forms in Poland, and especially in Poland, but in other countries, in the former Soviet Union, elsewhere, it does not exist. I mean, there may be survivors, and there may be recreations of some of the traditions and so on in other places, some still in Europe, some in Israel, some in the United States, Canada, and so on. But those communities simply do not exist. They were erased. And besides the people and the culture itself, you know, part of what the perpetrators did in the Holocaust was, and we see scenes, for example, in Schindler's List, where not only did people die, but it's as though they never lived. They never existed. And so you see scenes of pulverizing gravestones and turning them into literally rubble that was used to pave roads, that was used to create sidewalk. Veterans who fought for Germany in the First World War were literally sandblasted off World War I memorials in Germany, because Jewish veterans, because, you know, those people aren't German anymore. They do not exist. They're not part of the Volk. So whether they served in World War I, you know, for the fatherland is now irrelevant, because they're not Germans. So they were sandblasted. They don't exist. And that's a metaphor. So the knowledge is the knowledge that this can really happen. This planet that most of us consider some version of a shared home, even when it's not a very nice home for many people. And indeed, many people experience feeling kind of beside the point and irrelevant under a lot of circumstances in life, I will say. But genocide is that taken to perhaps the fullest extreme, where not only do you not matter, but you have no right, you're of no interest, your existence, the existence of your people, is of no relevance to the world as far as we're concerned. Forever, you're gone. You were never here. You know, that's a kind of distinct knowledge associated, I think, with genocide. So that's one example of what it means to be tortured. And I will say other, you know, this is not genocide specific. People who've gone through other rape, for example, and other experiences in which they are entirely helpless at the hands of another person. Helpless and hopeless, meaning they can scream, and if they're tied down, if they're bound, if they're terrified, if there's a gun to their head, you know, when there's no escape, no exit. If one has never had that kind of experience of total helplessness, of total deer in the headlight, then, you know, that changes forever. That's in the bones knowledge. That's actually what trauma most specifically means, that experience of complete terror from which one cannot escape. I'll just say quickly, I use this example with my students. The closest that most of us, thank God, know from normal experience to this is when we have a real nightmare, not just a bad dream, but a real nightmare. What's classic in a real nightmare is not only the scary thing that's happening, the guy with the gun is coming, the monster, where the car is going over the cliff, but what makes a nightmare is our helplessness in the face of that danger. There's nothing we can do. And so people say, it's like I wanted to run, but my feet were in molasses or in cement. I could not move. Most classically, people say, I wanted to scream, but no words came out. So I couldn't call for help. I couldn't do anything. I was completely paralyzed. That, in normal life, is, I think, gives us at least a hint at what living a real nightmare, real trauma, is like when it's not something, you know, you're dreaming, but something you're living. So that's also a kind of knowledge, knowing that one can be that helpless, that hopeless, that alone in the world is also, just now on an individual level, is also a kind of knowledge which goes beyond this or that particular memory.
Hmm. Recently, while doing another interview on this program, mm-hmm. I was introduced for the first time to a concept I had never heard of, and I don't know if this is something you've been encountered before or not, but something called narrative fallacy. And it's a concept, I believe, presented by an author named Nassim Nicholas Taleb in a book called The Black Swan. And he says, and I've not read the book, but just another author made reference to it. And it was the general idea of this particular thing of narrative fallacy is, and it came up actually in terms of someone who was resistant to the idea of a biography being written about them. And in citing his reluctance, he cited this concept of the narrative fallacy, that we all have this hunger to make sense of our lives through the use of story, by constructing some kind of narrative which ties together what otherwise might be inexplicable, and gives purpose to suffering we might have had, or in some other way alters the way we see the events in our lives, and allows us to see them in a better way, but this author would suggest in a maybe inaccurate way or self-indulgent way, or I'm not sure exactly how sure. best to put that. And I just was thinking about, as you talk about what a rich experience this has been for the many Holocaust survivors with whom you have interviewed, I wonder what you think of this notion that part of it is that we have this hunger to make sense of things that don't always make sense. And do these interviews, are they often leading towards that goal, or is it?
I think, I mean, what I would say is, it's a wonderful question, and because it allows me to say this, I would say these interviews are leading away from that goal in certain key ways. And you may recall one of the people I interviewed who was a very memorable person. This was a very memorable moment and kind of picks up on what we were talking about earlier. Someone I interviewed multiple times, and he kept repeating the same story, and he didn't realize he had. In fact, each time he would introduce it, saying, "This is the kind of thing I never remember. Oh, maybe I told someone a few years ago." Well, he told me 2 weeks before, but he didn't remember that. So here was a guy who kept remembering what he said he didn't remember without remembering that he kept remembering it. And I'm thinking, what's with this? And it's not like he did that with other episodes. So eventually, because we had a working relationship, this is another example of what you can do when you really get to know people. And I knew he would be interested, so it was no, I knew it wouldn't embarrass him or put him on the spot, anything like that. I eventually, and he was a very, very, very smart, reflective guy, and I eventually asked him, so, Leon, you know, you've raised this particular episode each time we've met. It's the one thing that you've come back to. Why do you think? And we had this whole back and forth about it. And he eventually said, I said, so something about, quote, and this is my word, this is my contribution. I said, so this story, and he immediately came back and said, it's not a story. And he was talking about his retelling in general. Talk about narrative. It's not a story. It has to be made a story in order to convey it, and with all the frustration that implies, because at best you compromise. You compromise. Now, that's a direct quote. It's not a story. It has to be made a story. I think what he was saying is very much like what you were calling, or the other author's calling, the narrative fallacy, that making a story, making a trajectory, something that makes sense, that coheres. In the context of experiences for most survivors like the Holocaust, stories like that are themselves survivors. Meaning, of course there were episodes that one can remember that made a certain sense, where, and that's what a story is. One thing follows from another. There's a kind of logical trajectory. There are identifiable characters. It sort of makes sense. And obviously there are those experiences, but they're like kind of lights in a darker space. And they always, if in my view, one learns to listen in a certain way over years, one realizes that these individual stories point to a whole other world, which is not tellable, or at least not easily so, in narrative form. And that's indeed, so that's what I said, that in the course of our talking, on one level, it's true that survivors recall and in a way can re-own and even recreate new narratives that are useful to them in the way that Leon said, as compromises, as partial and provisional ways of capturing for them and especially for their listener aspects of this experience. But at the same time, and survivors say this, especially again as you know them well, they'll say, you know, but all of that is just a little piece. All of that isn't really it. That story I just told you is really there to point to something I can't really tell you, or I may choose not to tell you because it's too painful to me, because I might get nightmares, real nightmares, afterward. So these stories are floating in a sea that's much bigger than themselves. So I think survivors agree with the author who talks about narrative fallacy. There's one of the latter chapters of my book is called On Having a Story to Tell. And it makes exactly this point that these stories, and everybody talks about survivor stories, are a fragile, as I said, provisional constructions. They're really important for that reason, just as survivors themselves are really important. But as I also say in the book, it's really important not to mistake the made story for the whole story, which is very easy for us to do.
Right.
Especially if it's repeated, like my friend. You know, we say, well, this is, quote, his testimony. Turns out it was barely the beginning of what he had to say.
As you say that, it reminds me of one other thing I want to ask you about.
Yeah.
You, at one point, say that everything survivors say in their interviews is part of their recounting. Survivors bring all of who they are to serious conversations about the Holocaust, their lives before and after matter. In other words, these conversations, although they, of course, are centrally about the Holocaust experience, in no way are limited to that, and that, in fact, a fair amount of time in these conversations was spent in conversation about other matters, at least on the surface, not directly connected at all. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just say a word about how much of that kind of conversation typically would be part of these interviews, and what kind of things would be shared of that nature that would be in some way revelatory.
Yeah. Very interesting. Another excellent question. I'll say first, I once almost wrote a paper which I almost called Let There Be Lunch. Because some of my good friends, survivors, were also wonderful cooks. And so, you know, what gets said over a meal is not necessarily the same as what gets said over a tape recorder or both. But as an example of what you're saying, one man, who I actually write a lot about in the book, but I tend not to talk much about him, which I'm not sure why that is. He's harder to talk about, but he was a very private guy and fearful. He went through life for understandable reasons, and this had a lot to do with the Holocaust, but it also had to do, in my view, with experiences before, thinking that this was a very tough world and that people would take advantage of you and would somehow exploit you if you allowed that to happen. So you always had to be on your guard. And this, unfortunately for him, he experienced that even within his own family, that his own kids, his own wife, you know, if you were a superficial psychologist, I will say, you would say this is sort of a paranoid guy. That doesn't tell us anything. You know, it's a label, but it doesn't get inside his experience. But one of the realities in our interviews, first of all, he didn't initially, he was reticent to be interviewed at all. Part of it was he feared that I would somehow take his material and use it in some way. I should be so lucky is what I was, but I would somehow make a movie out of it and get money, and I would rip him off, basically. And so he wanted me to, which I was perfectly willing to do, write up a sort of a contract that if any profit was made from our discussion, you know, he would get whatever share. And so I was very much an object of suspicion, and part of that was expressed in the fact that he did not want me to come to his home. As an example, I said earlier, we could meet, but in a kind of neutral space, although it wasn't entirely neutral. It was at a Jewish community center in a little room. He was someone who also kept mostly secret from his friends. His family knew, but he didn't. He was not active at all in the Jewish community. He was, in a way, always in hiding. And where we met was also kind of in hiding. His family did not know that we were meeting, and we met for some time, for over a year, pretty regularly. But this was all in secret. And then there was this, as I said, this sort of suggestion of a contract, and there was a concern that the theme for him was especially the young taking advantage of the old, and that could be, you know, if you're a Freud, you know, you have one version of that. And if you think about the Holocaust, it had to do with the sort of young German nation taking advantage, to say the least, of an older people. Jews just having had a longer history. So these metaphors came together, but they were expressed in this very specific way of setting up our relationship, that it would be secret, private. Hello?
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay, I heard the phone go beep.
Nope,
again.
Nope.
It would be off the record in that sense. Now, all that changed as we got to know each other. In fact, the first edition of the book ends with his saying to me, you know, I raised the contract. I said, is this still important? I'd be glad to do this. And he said, not, no. He said, you know, you look at me and I look at you. And anyway, it was an expression that he had come to trust me. But this was a kind of long process. And as I said, the whole way he constructed our relationship and sort of set the stage for our conversations reflected his wider story, both during the Holocaust and, I would say, his life more widely. You know, the Holocaust was one part of a life, very sadly, lived within a lot of fear. But, and I will say this too, when we got to know each other, and I'll never forget the importance of this, he also spoke not only in this way, but about his early romantic relationship with his wife. They were deeply in love. This was a woman, not Jewish, Catholic. They met in Italy. He came to the United States initially, and he kept going back to Rome. And he said, why? Because I'm in love. And he was at that time having some struggles with his son, who he thought was spending too much money on the phone with his girlfriend. And he said, but he was just like me. You know, when you're in love, you're crazy, and you'll do whatever. And so this was kind of this emergence of this entirely normal, joyous, real-life vitality in the midst of what was otherwise a very dark history and a very fearful way of being. So, you know, I would say with certainty, to the extent one can ever be, that this whole story of his early romance and connecting it with his son, which was really put the rest of his story in a new context, would probably not have emerged if we hadn't gotten to know each other.
The book is On Listening to Holocaust Survivors, Beyond Testimony, published by Paragon House, the author, Professor Henry Greenspan.
Coming up on 8:59... we will be joining Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming at 9 o'clock. Quick check on the forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy with a 50-50 chance of rain this morning, but then sunny and hot for the afternoon, a high of 86. Here are the current stats. Humidity 88%, a little sticky out there. Wind from the west at 7, 77 degrees now in Racine, 76 for Kenosha and Milwaukee, 73 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio, just about 9 o'clock.